You're listening to the BBC World Service. And now off the shelf, we begin with part one of a five-part reading telling the remarkable story of Billie Holiday through the voices of those that knew her. Julia Blackburn reads from her recent biography on the singer's extraordinary and at times controversial life.
With thee I swing, baby, for thou art so entrancing. My heart goes bing, baby, whenever we start to dance.
I am treading in someone else's footsteps. More than 30 years ago, a woman called Linda Coole wanted to write a book about Billie Holiday. As a way of beginning, she made tape-recorded interviews with more than 150 people who had known Billie at one time or another during her short life. Eventually, she had two shoeboxes filled with tapes, and so she began the slow process of turning all these spoken words into written words, until hundreds of pages had accumulated, a great babbling mountain of voices. The New York publishers, Harper and Row, agreed to take on the book, and for several years Linda Coole was busy with it. But it seems she could never get further than the first few chapters, which she kept on writing and rewriting. It was as if she was looking for the key that would open the door and make everything else follow and fall into place. In August 1977, Linda Coole's editor at Harper & Row explained in a letter that the book wasn't working. She said perhaps another publisher could be found who could take it on. She said, "God knows, if it's painful to me, it must be awful for you." Linda Coole moved over to Dial Press and went on with her manuscript. In January 1979, she had made arrangements to attend a Count Basie concert in Washington, D.C., and in spite of a fierce snowstorm, she travelled there by train from New York. She arrived a few minutes before the music began, looking quite flustered, and then she disappeared and didn't turn up for the reception after the show. It seems she went back to her hotel room, wrote a suicide note, and jumped out of her third-floor window. Her family kept her Billie Holiday papers until the 1990s, when they were sold to a private collector. I first got in touch with the man who owns the Linda Coole archive about 3 years ago. He asked me who the hell I was and what did I know about jazz. What was my story? Was I black? Was I a feminist? What made me think I was qualified to write about Billie Holiday? I did my best to answer these questions, and he sent me a list of all the people who had been interviewed by Linda Coole, along with a very rough but tantalizing description of what else was in the archive. He said that if he did agree to give me access to this material, it would not be cheap. We agreed a figure and drew up a contract. I went to New York and spent 3 days in a tiny office on Fifth Avenue, where I was shown bundles of files filled with loose sheets of paper. Everything had been jumbled haphazardly together. For about a year, I did my best to construct the bones of a biography out of this material. I arranged the interviews into little groups and tried to force all those voices into the cages I had constructed for them. But in doing so, I lost the wildness and the vitality that made them so interesting. That was when I decided this book must be a documentary in which people are free to tell their own stories about Billie. And it doesn't matter if the stories don't fit together, or even if sometimes they seem to be talking about a completely different woman.
Somebody thrills to the skies when she looks in your eyes. Guess who? Guess who? Somebody longs to be part of the song in your heart. Guess who? Guess who?
The facts. On the 7th of April, 1915, a baby girl was born in Philadelphia General Hospital. Her mother, Sarah Julia Harris, known as Sadie, was 19, and her presumed father, the banjo player Clarence Holiday, was 16. The baby was given the name of Eleanor. In 1924, Sadie got a house of her own on Dallas and Caroline Street, Baltimore, near to the docks and right in the heart of the red light district. She moved there with her daughter. Then, on the 5th of January 1925, the 9-year-old Billie Holiday was brought before the magistrate at the juvenile court in Baltimore. She was described as being a minor without proper care and guardianship, and was sentenced to spend a year at the local reform school, the House of Good Shepherd for Colored Girls. The school was a big, ugly, six-story warehouse on Franklin Street and Calverton Road in East Baltimore. It was run by a dozen or so nuns who belonged to an order called the Little Sisters of the Poor. They were provided with an annual income of $3,000 by the state of Maryland, but that was not nearly enough for them to feed and clothe themselves, let alone a shifting population of about 100 girls, who were mostly between the ages of 14 and 18. The sisters supplemented the school's income by taking in washing. The girls helped run the laundry, and also did sewing, crocheting, and knitting, as well as their household duties. Linda Cool spoke to a woman called Christine Scott, who had been born in the 1890s and sent to the house when she was still very young. I have no idea why. Maybe she simply lost all her family, and there was nowhere else for her to go. Whatever the reason, she was still an inmate when Billy arrived in 1925. She said she remembered how she was sitting on her own in the chapel one Monday morning when the chaplain beckoned her over. He had a very shy young girl with him, whom he said was called Madge. All the girls were given new names when they arrived. The chaplain explained that he wanted to have Madge baptized, and he asked Christine if she would be the girl's godmother. As Christine explained,
"He said he had an awful time trying to find out where she came from and where her people came from."
Something changed in Billy when she learnt she was going to be baptized. While she was being prepared for the ceremony, she was no longer so silent and fearful, and she told everyone in the house how excited she was. And when the day came, she was dressed like a bride in a white veil, and she rushed to show all the sisters how pretty she looked. But once the brief immersion into the limelight had ended, the little girl withdrew back into her shell.
"She liked me, and she didn't want to be with the girls. She never told me a reason. I didn't ask her a thing about herself or about her parents, and she never told me anything. She very seldom had anything to do with anybody else, and she was always down in the dumps. She never bothered with nobody. She very seldom spoke to anybody. She was almost like a stick. She sewed a lot, overalls, shirts."
Billy, in the form of a child called Madge, was released back onto the streets of Baltimore on the 3rd of October, 1925. Years later, Billy made one final visit to the House of Good Shepherd around 1950. She arrived with John Levy, her current boyfriend and manager, and in a flurry of excitement showed him around this place that had been one of her many childhood homes. Then Billy agreed to sing a song for the girls. The song she chose for the occasion was "My Man." The girls squealed with delight, while the sisters were appalled.
"He's not much on looks. He's no hero. Out of books, but I love him. Yes, I love him. Two or three girls says he, that he likes as well as me. But I love him."
Christine Scott missed this performance, but she was told about it later. She thought she must have been out in the yard feeding the chickens at the time, and nobody bothered to come and tell her that her famous goddaughter had returned. So she never had a chance to see for herself how the frightened child she knew as Madge had been transformed into such a bold woman, full of laughter and talk, her lips painted as red as blood, her mink coat slippery on her shoulders. Linda Cool asked Christine what she thought had happened to Billy, and why it had all gone so wrong.
She got off track. You see things, and you know how it is, how a young girl feels.
I have been listening to the tape of Mary Pony Kane talking about her childhood. Linda Cool interviewed her in October 1971 at her home in East Baltimore, not far from Durham Street, where she and Billy both lived in the same building for a while. Billy was the same age as Pony, but she was a tall girl and she seemed much older. When she first came out of the House of Good Shepherd, she was too rough for the people in Durham Street, but she and Pony quickly became friends, and for a while they went around together. They used to go to a 5- and 10-cent store called Broadway and steal clothes. Or if they wanted to smoke reefers, they'd go to a shop run by a lady called Miss Laura. She sold real skinny ones, which were rolled by a sailor who sat in the shop.
We'd get 'em and use 'em and go and play records, or hang out on the corner and whisper about the boys we like.
They began to spend more and more time at Alice Dean's house on South Dallas Street.
No one was stationed there. No, the girls would just walk in and clip 'em. I'd never seen people getting so much money so quick. The girls wore red velvet garters and satin slips and panties in all colors. Red, orange, black, lavender, green, you know, all colors.
Pony remembered that house as a magical palace, full of laughter and beauty and music. She and Billy used to do anything to be in there, just to be there, and they took on any jobs that were offered to them.
I'd polish the oilcloth on the floors till it shone as yellow as the sun. I'd wipe a bedroom door very, very slowly, while peeping in through the keyhole to see what the women were doing with the men. I tried to see as much as I could. I found out how it went. The rich guys who came round the neighborhood looking for sport were white men mostly. Very few colored men ever had the money. There wasn't no money in them days. A girl would make a dollar a trick, sometime a quarter. She'd go to bed all night with a man for $2 or $3.
Pony wasn't going with men then, but Billy was much quicker. She learnt the trade from working in the house, and soon she was ready to catch tricks in there, too.
Billy wasn't doing anything unusual. She just did like all the rest of them. She'd get a pair of stockings, wash 'em out, and put 'em on half-dry and go out. She didn't have too much of clothes or nothing. She wasn't making money. She was getting a meal, missing a meal, getting a trick or two. She wanted to be around where the happenings was. She was liked by a whole lot of boys, but she used to call them country boys. She wouldn't have no time for 'em. Hustling men liked her. They would come around and take her for nights out. She didn't have no time for the others. All the men were keen to hear Billy sing. She used to sing in nightclubs and maybe make $2 or $3 a night. She'd be singing Stormy Weather and Stardust and all those popular tunes. Everybody would be drinking whiskey and bawling, and she would sing and booze and dance. She'd sing like it hurt her, like it did her good to sing.
Why was I born? Why am I living? What do I get? What am I giving?
Well, Julia Blackburn was reading from her recent book With Billy. Christine Scott was played by Kate Harper and Pony Kane by Alib Parsons. It was abridged and produced by Emma Harding here on the BBC World Service.